Jogcast NAMM 2012 Special, Day 1, with Libby Jones. Hello and welcome to the Jogcast. I'm Libby Jones, reporting from the first day of the National Astronomy Meeting in Manchester. The National Astronomy Meeting is an annual meeting hosted each year by a different university. This year, NAMM has approximately 900 delegates and is being hosted by the University of Manchester. So as NAMM is on home turf, we thought we'd do a series of Jogcast specials reporting from the conference each day. I've just been in the session Massive Stars from the Milky Way to Beyond the Local Group, and talking in that session was Dr. Ben Davies from the University of Cambridge. And you were talking on red supergiants as cosmic abundance probes. So hello and welcome to the Jogcast.
Hello, thanks.
First of all, we'd like to start off with, what is a red supergiant?
So a red supergiant is a star that begins its life about 8 times more massive than the Sun, or a bit more than that. And once it's done hydrogen burning in its core, it puffs up to about the size of Jupiter's radius and becomes about a million times brighter than the Sun.
That's a very, very big star then, and very, very luminous. Mm-hmm. And how do you use these to probe cosmic abundances?
Well, because they're so bright, you can see them at extragalactic distances of millions of light years. You look at their spectra, you see absorption lines, and these absorption lines are due to metals such as iron, oxygen, silicon, and basically, just by measuring how strong those lines are, you can tell how much of that element there is. So if you see lots of iron absorption, you know the star's got lots of iron in it. And then that tells you about the chemical abundances of the host galaxy.
So these stars are just one part of the galaxy. Do you have to look at lots of stars to get an idea of the chemical abundance of each galaxy? Or can you tell it from just one star?
Well, one star gives you a good idea, but over an entire galaxy, you expect the abundances to vary. For example, in regions where you have high star formation rates, you produce more metals, and those metals get imprinted in the stars. So the idea is to do lots of stars and then effectively make a chemical abundance map of the whole galaxy.
So if you want to look at spectra, that involves quite a lot of telescope time.
Yeah.
And surely to see one of these objects, especially in different galaxies, that's going to require an awful lot of telescope time. Can you tell us how you can, is there a way to speed this up, or do you actually just need to have days and days of big, big telescopes?
Well, you can speed it up by being a bit choosy about which parts of the spectrum you look at. So if you look at one particular part of the spectrum, you might see lots and lots of lines and they're all overlapping and it's a big mess. And so there's nothing you can do really. But if you look at another region of the spectrum, you might see a smaller number of lines that are well separated. And so you don't have to disperse the light quite as much. And because you're not spreading it as thinly, you don't need to observe it for quite as long to get the signal that you're looking for.
And how many objects have you managed to look at, and how many different galaxies have you managed to look at so far?
Well, we're in the early stages right now. So at the moment, we've looked at our galaxy and the two nearest ones, the large and small Magellanic clouds. But we are at the stage where we're going to start doing things that are a bit further away, which coincides with the new piece of kit that's going on the big telescope in Chile, where we'll be able to do not one star at once, but 20 odd all at the same time.
Oh, so wow, so you can get lots and lots and lots of stars, and mm-hmm. then you can get an idea of the chemical abundances as you go back in time. Is that the idea? So if you look to further redshifts or further away, the stars will have gone through less cycles and births and deaths, and so there'll be less elements. Is that what you're trying to probe?
Yeah, that's roughly it. Not so much with going back in time, but with galaxy mass. So a very massive galaxy has higher abundances than a lower massive galaxy, and this is due to in a very low mass galaxy, a supernova which is producing all these heavy elements. When it goes off, it blows all those heavy elements out of the galaxy, and that never finds its way into the next generation of stars. So you see this relationship between how massive a galaxy is and its metal content, and that's what we're probing.
So the moment you've looked at the Milky Way, and then you looked at the LMC, which is a bit smaller than the Milky Way, and then the SMC, which is even smaller,
yeah.
Are you seeing what you're expected to see?
Yes, we are, which is good news. But at the moment, we're doing it on objects where we kind of know what the answer is going to be, just to test everything's working. And the next phase, we'll start to reach out to less well-studied objects, and that's where we're going to really start to earn our money.
And is this quite a very good relationship between the mass of a host galaxy and the metallicity of the galaxy?
What do you mean by good?
Well,
It's all right.
So there's quite a lot of variables that we don't really know about yet, so we need to actually get a constraint.
That's right, yeah. So the problem that exists so far is we know this relationship exists, but we don't know precisely what it is, because we know one galaxy is more metal-rich than another one, but we don't know absolutely what that scale is. And so our goal is to measure that scale absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for being on the Jogcast.
Oh,
I wish you lots of time in the future on telescopes so you can get all these spectra, and good luck.
Yep, thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. During NAM, there's lots of specialty lunches throughout the week. Today, it is the ALMA lunch, and I managed to catch up with Robert Lang about the latest status of the ALMA array and the results it's starting to take. You've been giving a talk about ALMA and the very first results. Can you briefly describe what you talked about today at NAM?
So now we're getting to the point that the first early science observations from ALMA are hitting the streets, and my job was to summarise the current status of the array, what has happened in the construction project over the last few months, and what the current performance of the array is, and also to look forward to the development programme, because even though ALMA has not yet finished construction, we're still having to think about the upgrades and new things that we can do later on after the end of construction.
So how far into construction are we? How many dishes have we got on the site?
At the moment, we have 22 12-metre and 7 7-metre dishes on site. Essentially, all of the parts for 58 antennas have actually made it to Chile.
Oh, wow. And now that ALMA's being commissioned and we're getting through the first early science phases, can you briefly describe some of the first observations that ALMA's taken?
Yes, I mean, we've been concentrating on what's called science verification so far. That's observations that have been done by other instruments and we repeat with ALMA just to make sure that we get the right answer. So that covers everything from raster maps of the sun with single dishes, regions of star formation, the nearest active galaxy, Centaurus A. That's perhaps the most spectacular result that was shown in Richard Hills's talk today, out to very high redshift galaxies where we're starting to see redshifted line emission in quasars at a redshift of 4.
So redshift we mean by looking back into the universe quite a long way back.
Exactly so, yes.
Fantastic. So we're seeing lots of new stuff, and ALMA's, I take it, they're improving and confirming what was previously observed.
Well, and indeed, in the later talks this morning, we started seeing the first of the early science results. Mark Swinbank from Durham gave a very nice talk where he was talking about a survey of submillimeter galaxies. These are things that had been imaged already by the APEX single dish in Chile. Now ALMA has imaged over 100 of them in a few minutes each, and we have much better fluxes, much better positions, and that's changing the whole situation of what they're identified with and what their redshifts are. ALMA is really working to do good science.
Fantastic. I wish you all the luck and planning for future upgrades as well with the new ALMA telescope. Brilliant. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you, as always.
One of the main talks today is on Juno's mission to Jupiter, and I managed to have a few words with the keynote speaker during coffee. So joining us on the Jogcast today is Professor Fran Breganel from the University of Colorado, and you're going to give a talk about the Juno mission to Jupiter. Can you tell us what's so unique about this mission?
Well, it's the first time we're going to be flying over the poles, looking down on the aurora. Then we're going to zoom underneath the radiation belts, avoid that hazardous area, over the top of the clouds. And by going very close to Jupiter, we will map out the gravity field and the magnetic field, and that'll tell us about what it's like inside.
That's going to be such a detailed look and that no one's ever seen before. Has anyone ever attempted such a dangerous mission and hazardous mission?
No, this is the closest we will have been mapping out these things. And it'll tell us about how the planet formed. And then that teaches us a bit about how the solar system formed, because Jupiter is the big planet in the solar system, the big bully in the solar system. There are now many giant planets around other stars. And so we're sort of learning about how different solar systems form. first understand ours in detail and then compare it with how exoplanets form in other places.
Because Jupiters are what we're detecting mostly in exoplanets, aren't we?
So, that's right.
So if we get an idea with this mission, then we can have a much better idea about the other exoplanet systems as well.
Well, indeed. So we'll know how giant planets form. How they end up close to the star is another problem. Someone else will have to work on that one.
But this will give you lots of detail.
Indeed.
I wish you lots of luck. Thank you very much for joining
us
today.
It's a pleasure.
Bye-bye. During the conference, there is also many new results and interesting data released. And one such press release today is by George Bendo from the University of Manchester. Can you tell us what is your press release?
Well, I've been working for several years on processing images of nearby galaxies from data in the Spitzer Archive, and I recently had a paper accepted for publication based on these images, and at the same time, I've also made my images available on the web for the first time today.
This is new data that's been released that you've processed and made available for science publication, so anyone can go down and download and look at these pictures and do science with them straight away.
Anybody with a computer can just look at the images themselves if they want to.
And these images are quite cold, so they show cold dust around in different galaxies. Is that correct?
I actually have images of both hot dust and cold dust. The cold dust images are kind of blurry, but the hot dust images are actually very, very sharp looking.
And we can see these in all different galaxies, all the dust lanes around the spiral arms and all sorts of things like that.
Yes.
Thank you very much, George, for telling us about your press release. Well, that about wraps it up for the conference today. I hope you enjoyed some of the interviews and we'll bring you more throughout the week. This episode was produced, recorded and edited by Libby Jones. So, until tomorrow, jod on. Bye.
Jodcast, NAMM 2012 Special, Day 2 with Jen Gupta. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast. I'm Jen and I'm here on Day 2 of the National Astronomy Meeting in Manchester. Today I'll be going to talks on high-energy astrophysics, cosmic carbon, outreach and hopefully lots more. And I'll be trying to bring you short interviews with as many speakers as possible so that you can get a flavour of what's going on today. One of the sessions this morning was on outreach and one of the speakers in that session was Dr. Rob Simpson from Oxford University who was talking about planet hunters. And now I've managed to grab him and Chief Zookeeper Dr. Chris Lintott in the corridor. So Rob, could you tell us a bit about your talk today?
Yeah, I was talking about, we collaborated at the Zooniverse with BBC Stargazing Live, which was here. It was in Jodrell Bank. And we found an exoplanet. So we took 3 days. We had a million classifications on planethunters.org. And over 100,000 people took part. And we helped discover an exoplanet, or technically an exoplanet candidate, but a very good candidate.
We've got CAC time, hopefully, this week. There's a pesky background. We found out, we saw the transit, we saw the dip in light when the planet gets in front of its parent star, and that's what Threppleton and Holmes and their friends on Stargazing Live helped us do.
Yeah, so Lee Threppleton and Chris Holmes are the two members of the public that first spotted two of the separate transit events for this exoplanet during the 3 days of Stargazing Live.
But the trick is we need to rule out there's a pesky background star that's just close enough that could be faking the transits. If it's an eclipsing binary, if it's two stars going around each other. And so we've used UKIRT data with the help of the Kepler team, and now we need to get KEC on it, and hopefully we can turn it from a planet candidate into a proper plant. Anyway, that's what Rob was talking about.
Can we back up a sec? So planet hunters use Kepler data, is that right?
Yes, planet hunters, you're looking at light curves from Kepler. The Kepler spacecraft is staring at about 100,000 stars. Very, very sensitive instrument. So I'm always told that it could see a mosquito passing in front of a headlight, which I guess is a slightly useful analogy. but it's very, very sensitive. And if you're aligned such that the planet going around the star is between you and the star, then you'll see a slight dip in the light as the planet goes across. And those are the dips that users on the Planet Hunters website are trying to mark and find and tell us they're there.
How many have you found so far?
Planet candidates, I'm not sure what the total is now.
Candidates were well over 100. Actual planet published ones, we've just got paper with numbers 3 and 4 is nearly accepted. I'll be talking about those tomorrow, so this is a sneak preview. And then we've got a long list of other candidates. We're finding that people are particularly good at finding weird and wonderful planets. And so we made an... Do you remember there was that planet discovered last summer going around a binary star?
Yeah, the Tatooine.
That's the one. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So we had an independent discovery of that, which doesn't count for anything because we weren't quick enough. But we think our users are particularly good at finding those because the presence of the two stars confuses the computer, the algorithms that the Kepler team use. And so we're just getting to the point where we can follow up on these because the patch of sky that Kepler's staring at is in Cygnus, summer constellation in the northern hemisphere, and so it's just getting to the point where you can observe it from Hawaii. So we've got some follow-up lined up over the summer, and we hope we'll have plenty more planets soon.
And Planet Hunters is one of many Zooniverse projects. Are there any others that you'd like to talk about?
We should definitely talk about the Milky Way project.
The Milky Way project is a sort of bubble hunting, if you like the analogy. We've got Spitzer data, beautiful images of these star-forming regions all in the galactic plane of the Milky Way. And we're asking people to draw bubbles and to find other objects in that data. And they've been doing that it launched at about the same time as Planet Hunters did. So it's December 2010. And we've created astronomy's largest catalogue of infrared bubbles. So there's a talk later about that, in fact. And there's a poster up here at NAMM. This is good doing NAMM, NAMM podcasting. And the Milky Way project has moved into a sort of second phase now, where users on the site are seeing the catalogue of bubbles that they helped discover. So we've entered a sort of meta Milky Way project where people are seeing all these gorgeous bubbles and they're now taking more precise measurements so that we can do better science. And one of the things we want to get out of this is to understand how stars form. We want to know if stars trigger the formation of other stars. And we want to understand the dynamics and the properties of the interstellar medium, that beautiful nebulous material you often see in images.
The only thing I'd add is that it's really cool, for me at least, because we've had Galaxy Zoo for nearly 5 years now, and that produced real scientific papers. But Planet Hunters has papers, Solar Stormwatch has papers, Milky Way Project is now producing real results. One project that hasn't yet, because we need more people's help, is the Galaxy Zoo Mergers Project.
Yes.
This is where we're getting people to smash galaxies together on their computer and fiddle with the simulations and see if you can match an observed merger. Now, we're nearly there. We've taken a close look at 100 mergers. We've had more than 5 million simulations run on people's computers. But we're sort of in, what is this, the Christmas special of Galaxy Mergers. We've got the best of the best up against each other. And so we just relaunched the site. Don't laugh.
Sorry.
So we just relaunched the site. And if you want to see the most spectacular simulations of mergers and help us find the definitive ones that will go on to the grand final of being in a paper and helping us understand Galaxy Mergers, that we need people's help right now. And that's at mergers.galaxyzoo.org.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, you talked about we have other projects. Zooniverse.org has all the projects listed by category. There's lots of them. You'll find mergers there and all the others, and it's well worth a look. There's far more there than most people think now.
Just before we finish, you launched a new project recently called SETI Live, which is something different. You're actually getting live data, is that right, from the telescope?
Yeah, I can't believe I didn't talk about SETI. Yeah, this is live data from the Allen Telescope Array. And so it's new for us because this is literally as the data comes off the telescope and we're looking for aliens. So with Jill Tarter, who many people know, who's the inspiration behind the main character in Contact, which is a film I grew up loving, and thinking that radio astronomers listened to...
Don't get me started on that.
Yeah, okay, fine.
we are in Manchester, near
sure.
Central Bank.
So. But SETI... So the point is that we're looking in crowded regions of the radio spectrum where there is a lot of interference, in which the computers at SETI have never been able to sort through. But we think if we can get people in the loop live and we can get a better understanding of what's going on, we may just find a signal. Obviously, the odds are, astronomical. But the telescope's there, it sends its data up to the website, and if somebody marks something and it's confirmed by other users, then within 3 minutes we can get the telescope back and pointing at the signal again. It's very different from things like SETI at home, where they're mostly using archive data. So SETI Live's exciting because you might find aliens. It's exciting because it's live data, but it's also exciting because this sort of live mode is, I think, where the Zooniverse is going in the next few years. There's lots of places where putting human brains in the process of collecting data is going to be very important.
Well, thank you very much, Rob and Chris. I've got to say this is a little bit weird because it feels like I'm listening in on a recycled electrons recording. It's probably what our listeners feel like when they actually meet job casters.
Yeah, this is probably, recycled electrons is our can we make a podcast with no effort?
Maybe we can.
Maybe we can. We can't aspire to be the Jogcast, but maybe we're the extra show, the extra half hour with wine tacked on the bottom.
The Jogcast on Jogcast.
That's right. There you go.
Well, thank you very much. Another of the sessions on this morning was on extragalactic transients, and I'm here with Tana Joseph from Southampton University, who was speaking about some X-ray sources. Could you tell us about your talk?
I studied the elliptical galaxy NGC 4472, and we found three very interesting point sources in this galaxy. Two of them are definitely black holes, and one of them is a possible black hole candidate. In terms of my research, I really wanted to be a black hole so I can write a paper about it. And then the other two candidates are, one is the first black hole ever to be discovered in a globular cluster, and the other one is also another black hole in a globular cluster, because I think black holes in globular clusters are kind of like buses. You wait thousands of years for one to turn up, but then once one does, another one comes along 3 years later.
So a globular cluster, is that a group of stars within this galaxy?
Globular clusters are dense groups of stars, not within the galaxy itself, but orbiting around the galaxy like natural satellites.
Okay, and something that people always ask is, if they're black holes, how can you see them in X-rays? Could you explain that?
That's a very good question that I also get asked quite a lot. The way we detect them in X-rays is not, the X-rays aren't coming directly from the black hole, but they're coming from an accretion disk around the black hole, which is just a disk of really hot and energetic matter that's formed around the black hole, almost like we think about a drain, like in your bath, the plug, the water swirls around before it falls into the plug. It's like that.
And these black holes, are they stellar black holes, so are they like the kind of mass of our sun, or are these really big ones?
They are not the supermassive black holes, not the really big ones. They are, I guess, between the mass of our sun and about 50 or so solar masses,
Okay. And where is this research going? So what can we find out about black holes and about these galaxies from this?
Well, first of all, there's I wouldn't use the word controversy, but there is a very old paper that was written in 1969, and they said that this person put forward that black holes shouldn't exist in globular clusters because of the motions inside the globular clusters, they would actually be ejected.
All right.
And so people have sort of just gone by that and used that as sort of a gospel truth. And my supervisor dared to be different and actually found these black holes in the globular clusters where everyone just thought that they wouldn't exist there.
That's really interesting. Thank you very much for talking to us. Another of the sessions this morning was on cosmic carbon, and I'm here with Dr. Paul Woods to find out about his talk.
So today I talked about doing some chemical modelling of extragalactic carbon stars. So we have some observational evidence from Spitzer spectra. These are mid-infrared spectra that in carbon stars we see a very rich chemistry in the circumstellar regions, and we find very strong absorption features due to acetylene, which is a very important molecule when you're looking at the chemistry around carbon stars. It feeds a lot of other carbon chemistry, and we find lots of long carbon chain molecules forming. And so we see this sort of indirectly from observations, but nobody has really looked at what effect this has on the circumstellar chemistry and in the formation of complex molecules.
So you're looking around the stars, not actually at the stars?
Right, yes. So what we see in the Spitzer observations is the entire star, but the modelling that I've been doing is in the regions around the stars, yes, because they're the regions that are most interesting from a chemistry point of view. That's where we find all the large complex molecules.
And so what does this tell us about carbon stars?
This tells us a lot about the molecules that they produce and then push into the interstellar medium. And by observing these molecules, these complex molecules in some cases, we can find out a lot about the sort of physical parameters of the carbon stars as well, their temperatures, the rates at which they push out matter into space, and the densities and the radiation fields that we find in these galaxies as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm here with Professor Mike Edmonds of Cardiff University, and you've been talking in the RAS community session about creating an astronomy museum. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, in a sense a museum, but it may just be a virtual idea, an idea of a museum, not an actual museum. The idea is that we're trying to look at what do we do with all the stuff that's been created over the past century or so to do with astronomy. A lot of departments have equipment, records, memories about doing important astronomy research over that time. And yet we haven't really formulated a policy. If people ask us, what do you do with that? And the problem is, if a head of department needs space in his department, one of the first things that may go is old equipment. His space is expensive, recording it's expensive, and so on. We're trying to have an effort over the next year or so to really get some idea of what the best way of recording stuff, preserving stuff, noting where stuff is, in order to preserve what is important for the future.
And is this something that amateur astronomy societies can get involved with?
It certainly, we'd certainly be interested in hearing from amateur societies, particularly if they have particular ideas how they would like to see things preserved and what they would like to be able to visit or access, either through the web or through visits and so on. And also, too, if they know of or have in their possession particular artefacts that they may want to keep and preserve, that's fine. But if we knew about it, it would allow people to do research on them or know about them if possible. And I know there are things in amateur possession which are important artefacts from the history of astronomy. So if also, too, if amateurs know about things locally that are going to be binned or recycled, as I suppose it'd be called these days, we'd be very interested to know. What we're trying to do is to set up a way of dealing with that. And in particular, the difficult thing about knowing how to assess whether we should or should not keep something. Should we record this or should we not? How do you have some idea about what's really going to be important for the future?
If people do have something that they think you might be interested in, is there a website or should they just get in touch with you?
The best thing is to contact us through the Astronomical Heritage Committee at the Royal Astronomical Society.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Well, that wraps it up for day two of the National Astronomy Meeting. I hope you enjoyed this episode. The editor and producer of this show was Jen Gupta. So until tomorrow, jot on.
The Jobcast, NAM 2012 Special. Day three with Christina Smith. Welcome to the third day of the Jobcast NAM specials. Today there have been sessions on loads of different aspects of astronomy and astrophysics, including binary star systems, cosmology, exoplanets, and the nature of galaxies. I managed to catch up with a few of the speakers and poster presenters earlier today. I'm here now with Professor Bob Nicol from Portsmouth University, who is giving a talk about the Dark Energy Survey. Can you give us a little bit of background information on what dark energy is?
Sure. It's going to be pretty quick. We don't know what it is.
Okay.
It's appeared about a decade ago. Mm-hmm. Some astronomers were observing distant supernova and appeared that they were moving quicker away from us than expected. Mm-hmm. And that caused us to reevaluate our model of the universe. And we now have a model of the universe where the expansion of the universe appears to be accelerating, not slowing down. And this is a bit odd.
Yeah.
Because when you usually think about gravity, as you've heard, gravity sucks. Mm-hmm. And so it pulls things together. And so we would have expected that the stuff in the universe, the normal matter, would have actually slowed down the acceleration. Mm-hmm. Whereas in reality, what we do seem to be seeing is that that expansion is getting faster and faster and faster.
Okay.
So what we've had to do is look for something that we can put in the universe that kind of acts as a repulsive force or an anti-gravity. And that thing we call dark energy, so it's repulsive and causes the acceleration of the universe. And one option is this famous thing called Einstein's cosmological constant. And so that's our favorite model for dark energy. But there is as many models of dark energy as there are astronomers.
Okay. So there's lots of different options to be pursued.
Absolutely.
And the Dark Energy Survey, is that
is that looking for evidence of it or looking for...
So I think we're coming out of a decade where we're now accepting the fact that the universe, 75% of the energy in the universe is caught up in this dark energy.
Okay.
So it's the majority of the energy in the universe. So now I think we've accepted it. We've had a decade of being skeptical and going, oh, I don't believe that, to a point now where we really have to understand it.
Yeah.
And so the Dark Energy Survey, I like to say, is the first survey that really starts to understand what dark energy could be, rather than just confirming its existence.
What's it actually going to be looking at?
So what the Dark Energy Survey has is it has four probes.
Okay.
So it's going to use four different objects to try and understand this dark energy. So the first one are clusters of galaxies. So it's going to try and find clumps of matter out there in the universe. And the Dark Energy Survey will see further and wider than any other survey to date. So it will see lots of these things. Okay. It's also going to use a technique called gravitational lensing, which looks for the distortions of distant galaxies because of the nearby matter. It's going to just look at the clustering of galaxies on very large scales. And the one thing I'm mostly interested in is it's also going to use these wonderful supernovae that were used to originally confirm the existence of dark energy.
So the instrument that's being used, is it one instrument? Is it a collection of instruments? Is it?
So it's one instrument. It's a brand new camera that we built. This thing is awesome. Okay. Imagine a camera that's the size of a settee.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
And pretty huge.
Okay. It's a ton. Okay, so it's big.
Wow.
All right. And it has 570 megapixels.
Okay. 570 megapixels.
570. So try and buy that in Currys. All right. You can't go out and buy this thing. All right. It's an order of magnitude than what you can get commercially.
Okay.
And so that's what we've been building over the last few years.
Okay. Wow. That sounds like an awesome instrument. And this camera, is it being used from the ground, or is it something that's being used up in space? Or
so we're using it now on the ground with a relatively old telescope, the CTIO 4-meter telescope in Chile.
Okay.
So we refurbished that telescope and putting this camera on.
Yeah.
And that's we're going to have 5 years using that that ground-based telescope to survey most of the southern sky.
And You're hoping in that you'll...
So what we hope, the numbers we expect, we're going to detect about 300 million galaxies.
Okay.
About 4,000 supernova, and somewhere in the region of about 100,000 clusters of galaxies.
Oh,
and the key is you not only do you need that large number of objects, but the camera also provides the best images we can capture from the ground.
Okay.
Because some of the techniques we're trying to use, like this weak lensing technique, really does need pristine images. You know those images you see from the Hubble Space Telescope?
Yeah,
they need sharp, they've got to be sharp, because we're going to measure the shapes of those galaxies.
Okay.
So it's not just that we want to see the galaxies, we want to measure things about them. We want to measure their shape, their color, their orientation, and that requires slightly better data than we've had to date. So for the next 5 years, we'll be using the Dark Energy Survey. That, I think, will give us a clue as to whether this thing called dark energy is what is the cosmological constant, this thing that Einstein had put in his equations now 80 years ago. All the present data points in that direction, but we're not 100% sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the Dark Energy Survey will tell us if it's the cosmological constant. But that really doesn't satisfy us, because we don't actually know what the cosmological constant is.
Okay.
So it's like moving the goalposts, really. It's saying, you know, it's relabeling the problem at some level. But in the next decade, we're going to have a satellite called Euclid, which is now the same size as DES in terms of the size of the camera.
But
imagine putting that into space now.
Okay, so it's going to...
So imagine having HST images over the whole sky.
Wow, that would be amazing.
Imagine the Hubble Deep Field across the whole sky. This is what Euclid's going to deliver. And what Euclid will do is it will test one final thing about this dark energy problem. One way out is to say that Einstein's theory of gravity is incomplete. It's not that it's wrong, because it works. It works very well on this Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But when we get on cosmological scales, general relativity may not actually be the correct theory of gravity.
Okay.
Euclid will nail that. Euclid will be one of the definitive tests of general relativity on cosmological scales. So over the next 10 to 15 years, we're going to go from DES telling us whether it's the cosmological constant to 15 years from now, Euclid telling us whether it's general relativity.
Wow, so it's really going to, they're both really going to help our knowledge of dark energy and what it really is.
Exactly.
Okay, sounds absolutely fantastic, and I wish you all the best with it.
Thanks very much.
I'm here now with Kelly Hambleton, who's a PhD student at UCLan and has just given a talk on heartbeat stars. What are heartbeat stars?
So heartbeat stars are a new class of eccentric binary system. Mm-hmm. They demonstrate increases in the light as opposed to the usual decrease from the eclipse. And this is because the two stars are interacting with each other to the point that they deform each other, and you see a greater surface area of the stars. And so instead of the usual dip for an eclipse, you get an increase in light at the time of closest approach.
Okay, so you said that they were an eccentric pair, so that means that they're on a non-circular orbit.
Yes.
Yeah. And you said that they eclipse, their two stars that are going to pass in front or behind of each other. Is there anything?
Okay, so they don't always eclipse. Mm-hmm. So as they pass close to each other, you get the increase in light. Some of them do actually eclipse, so you also get a dip in the light and an increase in the light. Other interesting things that you can see is tidally induced pulsations. So you get a kind of ringing, and it's because you get pulsations that occur on a set number of times per orbit. So you'll get five pulsations within an orbit, and this is a concise number. So when you fold the light curve, you'll actually see...
What do you mean by fold the light curve?
When you phase the light curve, so if you have a time series of, say, 50 days and the orbit is 2 days, then you fold the light curve every 2 days of worth of orbits, so you have just one full orbit.
So you're sort of like stacking it.
Yeah. On top of each other, yes, essentially. Then you still see the pulsations, and that's because they occur the same number of times every orbit.
Okay, and you said they were tidally caused, so that's just caused by the other star interacting.
Yes, yeah. So stars pulsate naturally. Most stars pulsate naturally, and it's because of the different cavities within the stars and the different ionization zones within the stars, and that decides what kind of pulsations the stars will have, the periods of the pulsation, so how long they last. And if the period of a pulsation is similar or very, very close to the period of the orbit, or if there are, say, for example, you get five pulsations within one orbit, so it's a precise number, then the tide and the pulsation will interact with each other. Mm-hmm. And this causes what you call a resonance. So the pulsations get a kick every time they get close to the star. So you get like this tidal interaction, and these pulsations have an increased amplitude to what they would usually have if there wasn't a binary system.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for starting to talk to me. And have a nice rest of the conference.
All right, thank you.
And finally, I'm here with Natalie Sukushpek, who is presenting a poster about her work, which is entitled The Search for Rare Objects in UKIDS. So first of all, what's UKIDS?
It's a wide field near-infrared survey that goes deeper than TUMAS, so can detect fainter sources.
Okay. Is it done from space?
No, it's located in Hawaii.
Okay,
on
nice.
On top of Mauna Kea. So we got to go there and observe, which was very nice.
And these rare objects, what sort of things are they?
I'm looking for either objects that are very far away, like very high redshift quasars, which would give us an idea about constraining the history of the universe or give us more information about reionization. But on the other hand, I also look for galactic objects that are very cool, because they get picked out in the near infrared as well. I'm looking for Y brown dwarfs, which are the coolest brown dwarfs, with temperatures between 300 and 500 Kelvin. And because the temperatures are so low, they're very close to the temperatures of exoplanets.
Okay.
So it could give us insight into the atmospheres of exoplanets.
Okay, that's awesome.
And then I'm also looking for ultra cool white dwarfs, which are the end of a star. And I'm looking for white dwarfs with, well, temperatures around 4,000 Kelvin or below.
Okay, that's, yeah.
Yeah, because the way white dwarfs work, the cooler they get, the slower the cooling is.
Mm-hmm.
So if an object is this cool, it means it's very old.
Okay.
Which would help us constraining the age of the Milky Way. I was also searching for a completely unknown class of objects, like something we didn't expect to find.
Mm-hmm. So something you weren't expecting to find? Like,
well, we didn't know what we were really searching for. That's why we tried to... We didn't look for specific things.
Okay.
We used chi-square template fitting to fit templates to a data set of over 4.7 million objects.
Okay.
And if the fit was bad to any of the given templates, which were stars, white dwarfs, quasars of any sort below the redshift of 5 or 5.9,
mm-hmm.
Or brown dwarfs that are warmer than, say, 500 Kelvin,
mm-hmm.
then they were fitted well with the templates we had, okay. and were removed from our sample, and we just picked out the objects that couldn't be fitted. So they okay. are considered rare and interesting.
Okay.
So we hoped to find some sort of unknown class of objects, which we haven't detected as of yet. But we have picked out some moderately interesting objects.
Okay. Just one thing that you said earlier is you used a chi-squared template. Is that some sort of statistical analysis tool?
Yes, okay. that is.
Okay, cool. So it's just using statistics. So.
Yeah. Okay. It's a statistical tool that also considers errors, which is very important because obviously every observation has errors.
Okay, brilliant. Well, I wish you all the best in the rest of your work and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you very much. I will.
In her interview, Natalie mentioned high redshift quasars. And just to clarify this, these are quasars that are really long way away, which means that they're looking at them from a long way back in time. Specifically, she mentions quasars at a redshift of about 5, which means quasars which are around about 12 billion light years away, which is a pretty long way away. And finally, one of today's press releases concerns a huge tornado which has been discovered on the Sun by Dr. Jing Li and Dr. Hugh Morgan of the University of Aberystwyth. The Atmospheric Imaging Assembly, which is an instrument, it's a telescope on board the Solar Dynamic Observatory, was used to observe the Sun on the 25th of September in 2011. And this actually observed superheated gases, which were being sucked up from the base of a prominence up into the upper parts of the atmosphere of the Sun, similar to that. The tornado, which is really, really cool. And there's a video being shown about it later today, and that sounds amazing. And I will link to more information on the show notes so that you can find out some more about this. And that brings us to the end of day 3 of NAM. The editor and producer was Christina Smith. So I hope you've enjoyed it, and until tomorrow, jot on!
The Jodcast, NAM 2012 Special, Episode 4, with Mark Perber. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast. I'm Mark Perber and this is the final day of the National Astronomy Meeting here in Manchester. It's been 4 days, it seems to have gone incredibly quickly, already the final day is rushing away from us, but it's been absolutely packed. We've heard about magnetic fields, pulsars, star formation, the Sun, exoplanets, exomoons, comets, alternative theories of gravity, numerical simulations, submillimeter astronomy, you name it, it's all been here this week. And there's been a wide range of social events, of course, as well. There's been a football tournament, there's been a trip out to Jodrell Bank, and there was a conference dinner last night in Manchester Town Hall. That seems to have taken its toll on a few people, because I saw one or two having a little bit of a snooze in the morning plenary, which I know was not to do with the talk, because it was very, very interesting. Some people have been burning the candle at both ends, but it's been great fun. So on the final day, I've been asking people for their impressions of the week and their favourite experiences, and also I've caught up with a few of the people during the day who've spoken, and I'm also going to do a little summary of the press releases and one of the sessions today. The first thing I did was to get a bit of a head start yesterday evening by talking to members of the Liverpool Astronomical Society.
Okay, well, it's Thursday evening, and I've just been having a chat to members of the Liverpool Astronomical Society about what they've been doing here at NAMM during the day. So perhaps you could introduce yourselves and tell me what you've been up to here today.
So yeah, hi, I'm Rob Johnson, and we've had a couple of solar telescopes, H-alpha solar telescopes, and been showing passing professional astronomers out of the conference views of the sun through the telescope.
Right, views in H-alpha.
So yeah, we've got a little PST telescope, which is a relatively cheap beginner's solar telescope, and but you can still see all the details on the sun. There's not much activity today. There's a sunspot. We've seen a few prominences, a few filaments across the disk, and earlier on there was within about 10 minutes. A prominence appeared, very bright prominence appeared on the southern limb, I think it was. And that was great, wasn't it, Dave?
It's been excellent, yeah. Very dynamic, the sun, constantly changing. You stand there, you have a chat, you go back to the telescope, it's changed. Prominences sprout up, they dissipate. Little ones come and go, filaments. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. And it's just minutes then for them to come
in
and go.
Minutes, yeah. over half an hour, we could see prominences growing. And then they just disappeared. And you think, where's it gone? Absolutely amazing to watch.
And what's the sort of size of those things that you're seeing?
Oh, goodness. When you get small loops, as the prominence grows and it falls back to the sun, it forms maybe a loop. The Earth can sit under that loop. There was a small, if I remember, it's a very small sunspot near the centre of the disk. That is the size of the Earth.
Right.
They're so small and the sun is so big.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. It brings it all to, you know, real terms, I think, when you see the scale of the thing.
It's nice to be able to do it during the day as well, do a bit of astronomy during the day. That's especially great. In Manchester, it's unprecedented amount of sunshine we seem to have had this week.
Well, yeah, we were really lucky that it was completely clear. Once again, we thought the clouds might come in, but it was another good day, yeah.
So it's the H-alpha, it's that particular frequency that gives you the chance to look at these prominences and things, is it?
Yeah, it's centred around 656 nanometers, so H-alpha. We had a second telescope, didn't we, which is somewhat upmarket, cost a couple of £1,000. A larger objective, a 60mm objective. Still same H-alpha.
Same band.
But being a larger objective, it gives you higher resolution image, and we had some great views through that.
Certainly did, some good detail. The weather has been good, it's clear, although with a slight haze. We could see, as the haze came and went, the seeing conditions equally come and go.
Okay.
And in those moments of good seeing, the detail just pops out at you.
Mm.
The filament was there, then it wasn't, then it was. And you've just got to get your eye used to seeing in red.
Right.
The sun is red, so we're looking in red light, and I don't think we're used to doing this normally.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to get dark adapted in the daytime,
okay.
Which is a bit unusual.
And roughly how many people do you think you've got to look through the telescope today?
Goodness, I've lost count.
I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 people, yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And what sort of reaction did you get from the delegates at NAMM when they were having a look through?
Yeah, I mean, they were really interested. We had obviously some sort of galactic astronomers and things, which never sort of look at the sun that much, and some planetary folks who equally don't look at the sun. But there were some solar physicists who'd never really looked through a telescope at the sun. And it was great that one guy brought his laptop along and showed us the live SDO image from just 10 minutes ago. And we were able to compare that image with what we could see through the telescope.
Brilliant.
So, yeah.
What I did find amusing was the gentleman, I don't know his name, I only saw him very briefly. And as he walked past, we said, "We'd like to have a look at the sun." He said, "Oh, it's okay, I've got one of those." Unbeknownst to us, until we found out later, he's actually got a telescope stuck to the side of the International Space Station observing the sun.
Wow.
I must find out who it was. I've already got one of those. I thought, he must have a solar max or something. Yeah. You know. On the space station, I mean.
Excellent. Well, one of the delegates who was having a look today was the plenary speaker, Frank Bagnall. So is it something that you get to do as a hobby very much? actually looking through a telescope?
No, I'm terrible about looking through telescopes, and I have not seen much of the telescope. But what I thought was interesting is that this morning we had one of the plenary talks, excellent talk by Alan Hurd from St Andrews, an overview of all these observations of the sun made by space and so on. All the detail, the stuff coming and going. But the thrill was really to come down here and look through a telescope with my own eyes. And those photons were coming from the sun through the telescope and into my eyes. And there's something special about that. It's,
yes.
You know, you can look at all the space images you want, but to actually see a planet or the stars or the sun with your own eyes and know that those photons actually travelled from the object and came to your eyes is something special. I think it's important.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, I think we should probably remind people not to look directly at the sun because that's too many photons. But I guess for that reason, because it's so bright, you actually don't really look at the detail of the sun. I mean, it's about the same size as the full moon on the sky, but you never get the chance to look at it unless you're using a special piece of equipment.
Well, there are easier ways to do it. You can project it onto the wall, which is sort of what Newton did and other people like that. Galileo, historically, measured the sunspots through projection. Or you can go to your amateur astronomy society and they'll have the equipment to help you do it. So, you know, I guess the next eclipse here in visible in the UK will be 2017. Find out where your local astronomy group is and go and hook up with them.
Okay. Well, the last thing I'll ask then is, are any of you going to be up at 5 a.m. on June the 6th to watch the transit of Venus?
Yes.
Yes. I feel sure we won't see it, but
British weather.
We'll be there.
You never know. We did see the last one, but we went to... initially, we went to Madrid, but we ended up down in Portugal on the border there.
That's right, yeah.
A long journey, yeah. But because of thunderstorms, we had to move to where the clear skies were. Britain isn't so kind with the weather and the clear skies, but we'll do our best, and
we'll
as we always do, and we'll worship the clouds as always.
Okay, thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Great.
This morning's plenary session was all about exoplanet hunting with the Kepler spacecraft, so I got the views of amateur astronomer Andrew Glester.
I've caught up with a Jodcast listener, which is Andrew Glester, who's here at NAM representing the West Didsbury Astronomical Society. We've just been in a talk about Kepler, the mission to find exoplanets. So how did you find that talk?
Well, it's fascinating. I think it's I think it's one of the most interesting parts of astronomy at the moment for me. I think it's, you know, looking for those planets out there. And, you know, I'm just an amateur, you know. I stand in my backyard with my telescope and look up and dream about what might be out there. And it's just really nice to know, you know, the science behind it and that there's people out there looking at it. You know,
it's a really kind of burgeoning topic now. There's really a lot of of exoplanets all of a sudden.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really capturing the public's imagination as well with that sort of thing. I think, you know, I know there's a slight overstatement of sort of second Earth that come out in the press, but you expect that from the press, you know, and then if people look deeper into that, then that's all good, I think.
Yeah. So about the rest of the week, you've been here all week, all the 4 days. What have you most enjoyed or picked up on?
Well, I'm an amateur, but I do sort of science communication through live shows, and there's two reasons for me being here. One is just pure interest, and the other is that I'm making this live show, which briefly will start with the Big Bang and end with the message that Carl Sagan once said, which is, we are a way for the cosmos to know itself. So I'm looking for ideas to sort of explore in the show, which will leave the audience in no doubt that we are indeed a way for the cosmos to know itself. And this is exactly the kind of conference where you can find that. When I say that, there's not many like this, are there, really?
No.
But, you know, it's just as an amateur to sit and listen to the proper people doing, you know, talking about what they're actually doing is really interesting, and to see sort of where everything is up to, because you read about these things, but to actually hear people talk about them is you know, really good, really, really interesting.
So was there any particular thing apart from obviously the exoplanets that was kind of your favourite thing or that you found very interesting?
I enjoyed the wonders of the solar atmosphere talk, because the aurora is something that's, you know, sort of also happening a lot at the moment with the, yeah. The activity around the sun, and it was really interesting to see that, because I don't know anything about that, so I learned an awful lot in that talk, which was, well, I say that, you know, whether I've learned it or not, but I certainly understood it at the time. But, you know, it's really, I think it's really brilliant, and I'd like to have come to more, really, but, you know, time limit.
Yeah, maybe next year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much.
No problem, thank you.
One of today's press releases was entitled Supersonic Snowballs in Hell, How Comets Explode, Fizzle Out, or Survive a Flight Through the Sun's Atmosphere. So I interviewed John Brown, the Astronomer Royal for Scotland, who presented that research.
I'm speaking to Professor Emeritus John Brown of Glasgow University, and he's been working on predicting whether comets that go very close to the sun will survive their journey. So the first thing I thought I'd ask you is, how do you actually observe these comets when they get so very close to the sun and it's so bright?
Yeah, well, we've been seeing them approaching the sun for several decades, actually, but when they get in within about 2 or 3 solar radii, they get possibly fainter than the corona, so it becomes very difficult. And it hadn't been done until July last year, and Carol Shriver and his team at JIPTA, Lockheed Martin, in California, I don't know exactly how he did it, but just around the same time as I had been thinking of the theory of these things, he did some careful detective work and managed to make an astonishing movie of a comet. I can't remember what it's called now. It's got a long string of numbers, quite a small one, scooting in through the corona. And he has a nice movie, it's on the internet, with a kind of a circular window around it to draw the eye. And it was done by looking in the ultraviolet with the Solar Dynamics Observatory in space, so you have the advantage of no sunlight, there's no scatter light. And it was I think the main movie was done in an ultraviolet wavelength of about 170 angstroms or so. So that helped to pick it out against the background. And that plus a very careful search in the right places, and they got a movie of it just fading out in the sun, in the lower corona actually.
So these comets you refer to as snowballs in the title of the talk.
That's what they are. I mean, they come from this Oort cloud or somewhere far out in the solar system, and they're made of frozen ices and dust and so on. I think they've got a density of about roughly half that of water, so they're quite fairly loose, dusty snowballs. And you know, this all goes back to early ideas. So there was the dirty snowball and the icy mud ball and things like that. But that's basically Fred Whipple from Harvard. He was the pioneer of a lot of this, and he proposed the dusty snowball concept and so on. And that's what happens when there are snowballs approaching the sun, and they progressively vaporise.
How do they end up visiting the inner solar system in the first place?
Well, these ones that we see are mostly, mostly Kreutz group comets, but there's various group comets. And these original, what they call primordial comets, they come from extremely far out from the solar system, almost out to the nearest star in huge circular orbits. And they go round and round there with hugely long periods. And now and again, a star nearby disturbs the cloud a bit, and some of these, their orbit gets disturbed and they start to fall in towards the sun. Now that's a normal long period comet. Hale-Bopp would probably be in that category. But sometimes these comets come in and they get so close to the sun, or possibly Jupiter, that they get torn apart. The tides raised by the planet tear them apart, and they end up breaking up into a huge long string of many small fragments. And we think that most of these sun grazers that we see belong to a group or groups, including the Kreutz group. So you get a string of them in almost the same orbit. And when I first ever heard of them in the 70s through the 80s, it was thought they should be very, very rare.
Because they don't live very long, I guess.
I think just to think there would be that. Well, possibly that any that had come close would have been wiped out before, I suppose. That's what you're saying. And however, it turns out there's actually about in the region of 3 a week. The patch, sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less, but at least 1 a week, I would say. So they're really quite common things, and these are all fragments of the same giant comet from the past.
Right. And then when they come in and they approach the sun, I guess the key part of your talk is that up to now it's been difficult to know whether the comet was going to be completely vaporised or whether it would survive. And I actually remember one of the recent ones where people were talking about it a lot, Comet Lovejoy, whether it was going to, as it passed the sun, come out the other side or not. And you were able to say something about whether it would.
Well, I tried to wager with my colleagues who were all working on this on the internet, tend to get a decent, I'm not a betting man, but I decided to gamble on a bet that it would make it. And nobody really won, actually. Nobody took me up on it. It did actually come out the other side. But it turns out, I heard just last week it came out the other side, but it no longer had a head, it was just a tail. So it was almost wiped out. But I couldn't have said for sure. It's more the opposite way around. If it comes out, you can work out how heavy it must have been. Because the heavier it is, the better the chance of surviving. So by seeing when it dies or whether it dies, you can actually figure out the masses of comets, which is useful.
I see. Yeah. And how did you model whether comets will survive?
Well, it depends. It turns out there's a really critical point, according to my modelling at least. If you come in with what they call a perihelion point, the closest point on the orbit to the Sun, if that is bigger than about 1% above of the Sun's radius, above the surface, so it's a pretty tiny fraction. If you skim, I call that a Sun skimmer, if you come in just above that, then the atmosphere doesn't really do much to the nucleus. It's just the sunlight that vaporizes it. So, and whether they survive or not depends on their mass. Any that go significantly lower than that, and we haven't seen any for sure yet, I call them sun plungers or sun plummeters, and they get into a denser part of the lower atmosphere. And because the way the sun's atmosphere is, it's got the density of the sun's atmosphere goes up very quickly as you go deeper. And once you get in there, you're more or less done for. You're not going to get back out. And every time they travel another few hundred kilometres, the density is a factor of 3 or something higher. And the ones in the corona, they vaporise reasonably slowly, you know, like maybe an hour, half an hour.
So the corona is extremely hot, but
thin. Well, come to that point, yeah, it's very thin. In the corona, they vaporise only due to sunlight, and I'll explain why. Okay. Once they go deeper, sunlight becomes irrelevant, and it's the friction of the atmosphere, which can be enormous. Actually, if you could get near to the surface of this, so-called surface of the Sun, the photosphere, down there, the heating by the friction is just what makes the shuttle heat shield glow. That kind of friction is 100,000 times more intense than the sunlight once you get really deep, so that's terminal. In the corona, there's been some silly misunderstandings in some of the stuff on the internet about Lovejoy. People saying Lovejoy miraculously survives the 2 million degree corona, and that's just wrong. The hot corona has nothing to do with it, as you just said. The corona, although it's at 2 million degrees, is very tenuous, and I figured out, if I got the sums right, if you were to put on your kind of reflective jumpsuit to protect you from the sunlight, so bright white, perfectly reflecting, and just lie there, the warmth you'd feel from the hot corona is only about the same as a sunny day in Manchester.
Really?
It's almost exactly about a kilowatt per square metre of your body, and it would take about a year to vaporise a comet. So it's not that does it, it's nothing to do with that, it's the sunlight. Patrick Moore's very strong on this. If anyone talks about the corona being hot, he says, yes, well, it has a very high temperature, but it doesn't have any heat.
So it can't get things into thermal equilibrium with
It's sort of in thermal equilibrium. It's just so tenuous. It's hot particles, but there's so few of them touching you, you don't really feel it.
Okay.
So the comet doesn't feel it very much either. So the corona could be much hotter, and it still wouldn't make much difference.
And do you learn something about the Sun when you observe these comets, or do you mainly learn about the composition of the comet?
Well, in principle, we could learn both. At the moment, we're just starting to try and do each of these things. But the thing that got me very excited is if the comet plummeted or whatever, especially in the case where it goes deep and explodes, what you actually get is a whole comet exploding like what they call a flash spectrum. And if you had good observations of that, in principle, you could maybe study the chemical composition of the whole comet. I mean, everything we've done so far, like Deep Impact and others, it's just been touching the surface. We don't know what's inside, really. So that potentially very good. Also about the strength of comets, the masses of comets. But we've also seen, especially with Lovejoy and the July 2011 comet, that they pass through the atmosphere and a fairly straight tail just running behind, as usually happens with the comet. And suddenly this tail whips and lashes around, and it looks as if it's happening as the comet runs through probably a strongly magnetic part of the corona. So we've now got comets as probes of the Sun's atmosphere. That's why I'm giving a talk today to the solar session, because there's potentially maybe a whole new way of doing solar atmospheric physics as well as cometary physics.
Okay,
And I guess the last thing I thought I'd ask you is, these comets, have they been around in their present form for a long time before they make their journey into the sun?
Well, the big ones that come from way, way out, like Hale-Watts, I think it can be how many tens or hundreds of thousands of years. I think the group comets tend to be somewhat shorter periods, maybe, let's just guess, say, less than 10,000. So they've been around for a while. The only thing is, I mean, I'm very, very keen, because I'm the first person who's worked out at all the theory of the kind of impact of the exploding ones, and I really, obviously, really like to see some. But most of them may already have gone. You know, if they go that deep, they're going to be destroyed for sure. So if they've been around more than once, that's it. It's all over. So to see those, would really depend on the orbit being a bigger orbit being disturbed to go a bit deeper into the sun. They've all been around for quite some time, but not as old as the solar system.
Right, I see, yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, pleasure.
There have been poster sessions throughout the conference with people presenting their work, and there was an award, one in geophysics and one in astronomy, for the best posters. I talked to Ewan Barr, the winner of the Astronomy Poster Award, about his work, and he's a pulsar hunter.
I've just caught up with the winner of the astronomy poster competition at this year's NAMM. He's from the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy. It's PhD student Ewan Barr. So maybe you could just tell us quickly what the poster's about.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been working at the Max Planck Institute for the last 2.5 years, and in this time we've been using the Effelsberg telescope to do targeted pulsar searches into what we call unassociated Fermilat sources. So these are gamma ray point sources, which there is no known companion, either blazar, pulsar, AGN, or so forth. And what we do is we spend a long time integrating on these sources in the radio and perform a normal pulsar search on them. And we look to find pulsars which can't be found in the gamma rays. Now, this is interesting because the LAT itself receives very low photon counts from gamma ray pulsars in general. And so if you have any kind of binary motion in your system, it completely obscures the rotational frequency of the pulsar. So what this means is the LAT selects against finding millisecond pulsars, and with the high photon counts that come from radio observations, we can bypass this selection bias and we can find millisecond pulsars in this data. And so after conducting a search of almost 300 of these sources, we came across a new binary MSP system, millisecond pulsar system, that is. This is a 2.65 millisecond pulsar in a binary orbit with a white dwarf. And what's interesting about this is that the white dwarf appears to be a very light system of about 17 Jupiter masses. And this implies that the system is what is known as a black widow system, in which you have a white dwarf and you have a normal evolution for the binary. It's gone through a low mass X-ray binary system, and what happens is the pulsar wind is so strong that it's gradually ripping material off the white dwarf companion. And so what we have is this ablation of the white dwarf causing it to lose a great deal of mass. Now, in the context of other Fermi discoveries, this is interesting, is before Fermi came along, we only knew of two of these types of systems. And now, with radio searches by observatories all across the world, we now know of 11 that have come from this. And this really highlights the importance of these kind of searches, these kind of targeted searches, as they uncover populations of pulsars that are lost in normal pulsar surveys. So yeah, with this, we look to kind of continue to do these things in the future. Fermi will keep on running for many years yet, and hopefully it will continue providing these targeting points for us to follow up, and hopefully there's some more pulsars in there too.
So was that millisecond pulsar then originally detected in gamma rays and then followed up with radio?
Yeah, essentially what the unassociated sources are a huge mix of things. Most of them are AGN or blazars, and what you can do is you can fit the spectra of these things, and what you do by ranking them in certain ways, you find the probability of pulsarness, let's call it. And what we do is we take these ones that have been what we call gamma ray selected. They've been found as point sources in the gamma ray, and we follow them up with very deep radio observations. And this allows us to find weak pulsars which are selected against in normal pulsar surveys.
Okay, well, I wish you all the success in finding more millisecond pulsars that way in the future.
Thank you very much.
As the conference drew to a close, I got the views of PhD student Kira Quinn on the planetary session that she was attending.
Despite her attempt to get away, I've captured a PhD student, Kira Quinn, who was in the last session, one of the last sessions of the conference on planetary science, and told her that she can't leave until she tells me a little bit about what happened in that session. So, Kira, what was your favourite thing about the session?
My favourite talk was the explanation of how we characterise the atmosphere of rocky planets. So these are obviously really exciting objects because they're the best places for finding life outside of Earth.
Okay.
So the talk was explaining why new telescopes such as the James Webb Space Telescope and the ELT are going to be really, really useful for finding more of these small rocky planets and the spectral signatures that we need to find life.
Oh, so they're going to be able to find out that about their composition and what's in their atmosphere and things like that.
Yeah, so they're looking for biosignatures, which is like methane and water and CO2 and ozone. That means they have an atmosphere and then could hold life. We're also looking for the presence of liquid water, not ice, because these biosignatures can't come through it. But if there's liquid water, then you might be able to detect these molecules.
Well, that's exciting. So you're at Cardiff University.
I am.
What do you work on there? Is it related to this at all?
Not really. I work on star formation, so I guess there's a bit of an overlap that you get star formation and planet formation kind of happening in roughly the same way. Hmm. But I work on isolated star formation, so that's low mass stars forming on their own outside of giant molecular cloud structures.
Okay. And you had a poster, was it, this conference?
I did, yes, in the first poster session.
So what did it cover in particular?
It covered a subset of the cores that I'm studying. I have a sample of about 40 of these small isolated molecular clouds.
So they're like pre-stellar objects, is that what you'd call them?
Yeah, some of them aren't even gravitationally bound. They're mostly just associations of gas.
Okay.
We don't know if they're ever going to form stars. Most of them don't have any signatures of it yet, so that's why they're interesting. They're the very first signpost of star formation. It's what we're looking for. So these cores are interesting because they're single star formation events. Normally they form in big clusters, and you're not sure if stars form the way they do because there's lots of them together, or if one star formation event causes another, things like that.
Okay.
So having a little one stars forming on their own, that's interesting and new.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So that's the end of the conference. People are on their way home, and I thought I'd just finish off by summarising a couple of the other press releases that we had today. One of them is about using pulsars as interstellar beacons so that future astronauts can navigate their way across the universe. Now, I probably wouldn't say universe, I'd say maybe galaxy. But this is an idea that's been around for a while, and work has been presented on it by Professor Werner Becker from the Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics in Garching, Germany. And in particular, he wants to use X-ray pulses as these navigational beacons. Now, the interesting thing about pulsars is with their timing, when you look at the timing solution, we look at when the pulses arrive, it tells you something about not only the spin period of the pulsar, but also how far away it is and how fast you are moving relative to that pulsar. So if you make a timing solution from Earth, and then you go off in a spaceship, you can look at how the timing solution changes for a pulsar, and it can tell you about how fast you're going in the spaceship relative to the Earth and how far away from the Earth you've gone, and also in what direction. So in principle, you can navigate using these things. It is really interesting because it is technically very challenging, and this is why sometimes people are a bit cautious about it. You can lose a timing solution if a pulsar, for example, glitches, if it suddenly spins up, as occasionally they do. So you'd have to use a number of pulsars. The other thing, of course, is taking the equipment with you on the spaceship to make the detection. And then another technical problem is how do you keep the clock on the spaceship synchronized with the clock on the Earth? Because it's very, very important to keep your clock accurate in order to keep track of the timing solution from the pulsar. So you need a very good clock. However, Professor Becker has suggested that pulsar navigation could be used for interplanetary spacecraft and eventually for interstellar spacecraft. And it could be to augment artificial signals for navigation. And the other press release relates to the work of Sergei Zharkov, who works at University College London's Mullard Space Science Laboratory, and he was talking about how solar eruptions cause sunquakes. Now, sunquakes might be a bit of an unfamiliar word, but they're analogous to earthquakes, only a lot more powerful, and they tend to be associated with coronal mass ejections, eruptions of material from the sun. Now, by observing during 2011, Dr. Zharkov and his co-authors were able to find that solar flares were related to sunquakes that could be 1,000 times more powerful than the earthquake that struck Japan in March 2011. And there had been a prediction of sunquakes 40 years ago, and they are sort of ripples coming outwards on the sun, because of course the sun's not solid, but is rather a plasma, which is like a very hot gas. Dr. Zharkov is analogizing to a stone dropped into a pond, causing ripples. But the actual release of energy that causes them is below the solar surface. And this actually produces sound waves that produce ripples, they're pressure waves. So that's sunquakes. And that concludes today's episode, the fourth and final one from the National Astronomy Meeting in Manchester 2012. We really hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. It's been manic, but it's been great fun, and we've all learned a huge amount. This episode was presented, edited, and produced by Mark Perver. So we shall be bringing you further interviews from the meeting during the forthcoming Jodcast episodes. And until then, Jod on!